Today we're going to travel with the people of Israel towards the promised land. Now here's the thing, there's going to be this trip and it's actually a pretty simple one. The people of Israel are up in northern Egypt in Ramesses and they're going to be making their way to Canaan. And actually it's a very simple trip, just right across the north. There's a should be no hassle with this, actually. God says, I've come to bring them out of Egypt into a good and spacious land flowing with milk and honey. Northern Egypt, around the bend, Canaan. If you got maps in the back of your Bible, you see this. It's pretty easy. The only bad thing is they have to go through the Sinai Peninsula, but if you go over to the top, that should be no big deal. The trip is about a trip of 200 miles. Today, to give you an idea, that's Rhinelander to Madison. Doesn't seem that bad, does it? By a walk, it may take a little bit longer. But they all knew the route they would take there. Everybody knows the shortest distance between two points is straight line. And this was pretty much a straight line on the road those days. There was an international trade route called the Way of the Philistines. And it followed from Ramesses right up into Canaan. It was a trade route. It was a military route. It was the way of the Philistines. Isaiah 9:1 called it the way of the sea. And in Latin, it's called the Via Maris, which means the way of the sea. It was a beautiful scenic route, traveled right along the Mediterranean. They all knew the way they were going to go would be a short trip, a matter of weeks, probably not even months, but weeks. And then we run into something surprising in Exodus 13, and we're told that God makes a decision. It says, when Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the Philistines. That's the road we're talking about, the Via Maris. Although it was nearer, for God thought, if the people face war, they're going to change their minds, and they're going to head back to Egypt. This road was heavily fortified. Remember we talked about the military presence of going back and forth? There was one fortress there called Charu, T-J-A-R-U, that was pretty significant. It was like the entry point into the Egyptian kingdom, and the way of the Philistines traveled right into Charu. Now, what's going to happen is when they come against this fortress, these guys may not know what just took place over in Ramesses. And now the people are coming, and they're going to run up against part of the Egyptian army. And God says, you know what? The minute they see those guys, they're going to hightail it and head right back. I've got to do something different. He knew they were frightened. He knew they were timid, that they didn't have a lot of faith at this time. That if they ran into opposition, they're going to turn tail and they're going to head on back. So he doesn't send them this way, even though it was the fastest and direct way to get to the promised land. There's a couple other roads that kind of cut through the peninsula, pretty much went east and west, even with a southeastern trajectory. It's a while out of the way, but it's doable, and God didn't send them on those roads either. And then there was another road that went almost directly south. And when God led the people across the Red Sea and started them on this journey, this is the road that he led them on. It's the way of the wilderness. Now, nobody knows exactly where Mount Sinai is, but recent studies, some people think it's in the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula. Actually, most recent studies in archaeology are finding that maybe it's even across the Strait of Aqaba into Saudi Arabia, just straight across from the peninsula. People are still trying to work out, but everything that it looks like, I think I was talking to Dean a little bit yesterday, and he was telling me that they're even finding chariot areas at the bottom of this ocean that have been grooved in during this area, some of the latest discovery. Doesn't make a difference, okay? It does, but it doesn't, okay? I don't want you to say, well, Dan says it doesn't make a difference. It makes a difference, but it doesn't make a difference. Does that make sense? You get a feeling this is going nowhere quick? Let's get back on course, okay? So they head down to Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, and they're there for about a year. They're camped out. They're anxious to get to the promised land, but there's things that God has got to teach them while they're in the wilderness. So they're down there. They're wanting to get on this trip. They're there for about a year. And finally, it's time to break camp. The pillar of cloud and fire is going to lead them. They're going to go up to the promised land. Now, from this area up to the promised land, there is a road that we know about, and it's called the Mount Seir Road, S-E-I-R. It's kind of the boundary to when you get up to the promised land. There's a town by the name of, there's an area called Kadesh Barnea. That's kind of the entry point, the gateway to the promised land, okay? Deuteronomy 1:2 says this. It takes 11 days to go from Horeb, Horeb's another name for Mount Sinai, to Kadesh Barnea by the Mount Seir Road. This is an 11-day trip. Now, when you have a couple hundred thousand, you may want to add a couple days onto the backside of that. But they've spent a whole year down at Mount Sinai. Finally, it's time to leave. They're excited. They're on this 11-day trip, give or take. And how long did it take them to get to the promised land? So they've been down there a year. How long from that point on? 39 more years. 11 days worth of real estate, 39 years of travel time. I'm serious about this because here's the lesson. God's not in a hurry. God's not in a hurry. And this is difficult for us because God's primary concern is not speed in our lives. Ours usually is. I mean, how many of you on the way here on Saturday and you've got little children heard this comment? Are we there yet? How many more towns? How many more minutes? I have to go to the bathroom, but are we there yet? Are we there yet? Do you remember those days? Are you living those days? And sometimes they can get really creative and they start singing songs about, are we there yet, right? And you're just like, stop it. We'll be there when we'll be there. Are we there yet? And you know, we look forward to that day when our kids grow up a little bit and they stop doing it, but what we realize is we're kind of like those kids. God, are we there yet? Get me into this job. Get me into this relationship. Get me into this financial condition. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Get me into this house. Are we there yet? God knows, and he still knows. God knew that where they were going was not as important as the type of people they were becoming as part of the journey. You see, having a land flowing with milk and honey was not as important as having a heart flowing with justice and courage and faith. Having a portfolio flowing with dollars or a job flowing with power doesn't matter nearly as much as having a character that flows with the fruit of the Spirit. You see, God is just as concerned about our journey as he is about our final destination. God kept his people in the wilderness because he had lessons that he knew they needed to learn along the way. And the thing about the wilderness is it doesn't have a lot of distractions, does it? You ever been in a wilderness expedition? In the wilderness, people are a lot more likely to pay attention to God. And man, if you just do a word study on wilderness, about 8 years ago, we went through a job situation, transition, ministry transition, where we were called away for 9 months. We went to this place and we found out that just about the time we got there, that there was some financial improprieties. I went in, I never spoke, I never taught a class, I never gave a sermon. All I did was fix the operations of the church. And it was a horrendous time in our life, wasn't it, honey? Oh yeah, she says. It was a wilderness experience. And during that time, I actually started doing a word study on wilderness in Scripture. And I started looking at the lives of David and Elijah and Moses and Jesus. God usually takes us to the wilderness to create us for what he has planned later on. If you haven't been to the wilderness, get ready. You're going to go there. We all have to go through the wilderness sometime in our life. So today, we're going to learn some lessons from the wilderness experience of the Israelites. So turn in your Bibles to Exodus 15. We're going to walk along. We're going to see where God is going to form his people out in the wilderness. And we're going to look at several passages that share a real common theme here. In Exodus 15, 22, the Israelites have just been delivered from Pharaoh and his army. They've crossed the Red Sea. He's given them miraculous redemption. And here's what happens. Notice how long this takes. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert of Shur. For 3 days they traveled in the desert without finding water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink it because it was so bitter. That's why it's called Marah. So the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What are we to drink?" Now you think, wouldn't you, since God just delivered them, God's just performed 10 plagues, he's drowned Pharaoh and his army, they've seen the Passover, and now they come and they go, "We haven't had water for 3 days. I can understand that. We're thirsty. But what have they just seen?" And they have this doubt. 3 days, God's at the wheel, and the kids are whining in the back seat. But God's providing miraculously. He tells Moses to throw a piece of water, wood in the water, and he does, and it purifies the water. And once again, they're living in this freedom. And they have miraculous guidance and direction, and now they have water to drink, and you think, good, the kids are taken care of. We can travel for the next hour without any complaints. Exodus chapter 16. The whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. So they're heading south now. On the 15th day of the second month after they'd come out of Egypt. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and we ate all the food we wanted, but you brought us into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." Did you notice verse 3? "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt." Have you ever really seen a really good tantrum? You know, a kid is on his game that day. And most of the time when you see a tantrum, you go, "Oh, just knock it off." But there's those days that you go, "That was really good." That kid took that to a new level. That kid's got this down. The way he threw himself on the ground was a work of art. "That was beautiful, son." These guys are taking this to an art form. The people are complaining. "We're not asking for much, just death. There in Egypt, we sat around pots of meat and we ate all the food we wanted." Does anybody remember what they did in Egypt? What were these people? They were slaves. They didn't sit around doing fondue all day long. They were slaves. But you know, one of the things that discontent does is it plays with our mind and it distorts our perspective. You see, discontent leads to bitterness, which really leads to resentment. And you begin to exaggerate how bad your condition is, and all of a sudden we put on the rose-tinted glasses and we look at how things used to be or how things are for somebody else. That's just human nature, and that's what's going on here. Verses 6 through 12, see if you can pick up the key word in this text. It's one of the key themes of Exodus and Numbers. "So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, 'In the evening you will know that it was the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, and in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord, because he's heard your grumbling against him. Who are we that you should grumble against us? Moses also said, you'll know that it was the Lord when he gives you meat to eat in the evening and bread you want in the morning, because he has heard your grumbling against him. Who are we? You are not grumbling against us, but against the Lord. Then Moses told Aaron, say to the entire Israelite community, come before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling. While Aaron was speaking to the whole Israelite community, they looked towards the desert, and there was the glory of the Lord appearing in a cloud. Then the Lord said to Moses, I've heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them, at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I'm the Lord your God. What's the key word? Grumbling. Over and over and over. It says several times, the Lord heard their grumbling. God hears. And honestly, as parents, when you hear, are we there yet? Are we there yet? What's your response after the 30th time you've heard that? Find something to do. Knock it off. You'd think that God would get impatient or that he'd get upset. But what is he? He's gracious. Verse 13, that evening quail came and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost on the ground appeared in the desert floor. And when the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, what is it? For they didn't know what it was. Moses said to them, it's the bread the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord commanded. Each one is to gather as much as he needs. Take an omer for each one you have in your tent. You see, this term kind of became a joke with the Israelites, because Hebrew, does anybody know what manna means? What is it? That's what manna means, because they don't know. What do you want for breakfast? I'll have a bowl of, what is it? You know, when my wife's gone, my kids eat manna all the time. Dad, what is it? Verse 14 says, when the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost appeared in the morning. Do you realize what they're eating? Frosted flakes. Where's the drum roll when you need it? So what's God trying to teach them? Moses makes this real explicit in Deuteronomy 8 and 4 when he's looking back on the episode, and it's decades later, and he says, God humbled you, causing you to hunger, and then he fed you with manna. And it wasn't just hunger that God provided. It also says, your clothes did not wear out and your feet did not swell. Did you ever notice that before? Not only did he provide food, what else did he provide for him? Clothes and sandals, shoes. Can you imagine traveling 40 years, 39 years, sandstorms, everything else that goes out in the wilderness? Clothes are going to wear out. You know, there weren't Targets out in the Valley of Shur during those times. It says, you didn't get your clothes at Macy's. The Lord was the tailor. God says, I'll take care of you. I'm enough. You can trust me. Now, there's an important rule about manna gathering that we have to look at. Verse 17, the Israelites did as they were told. Some gathered much and some little, and when they measured it by the omer, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little didn't have too little. Each one gathered as much as he needed. Then Moses said to them, no one is to keep any of it until morning. However, some of them paid no attention to Moses. They kept part of it until morning, but it was full of maggots and began to smell, so Moses was angry with them. So here's the rule, and I can tell you this does not originate with me. Many, many speakers talk about this. Here's the rule. It's called the manna rule. The manna principle, which is one day at a time. God will provide for you one day at a time. Trust God for today. He is present. He is with you. He is a provider. He is a deliverer. He is a promise keeper, and he promises to do it today. You see, some of us get anxious. Some of those people got anxious, and actually some of them got greedy. Some people got afraid, and some people thought they were going to beat the system by being really clever. But God had something very important to teach them, and it's the manna principle, and it's the same way that he calls us to live. God says, I want you to live your life trusting me one day at a time. Just this day. Just learn to trust me for this day, because if you start worrying about tomorrow, guess what? You're going to worry the whole life through. If you're going to start getting anxious about tomorrow, guess what? There's always going to be a tomorrow. Your life is going to be revolved about worrying about what lies ahead. And he says, and you're going to miss my provision and my presence today. If you worry about tomorrow, you will worry about your whole life. God says, I really am going to take care of you, but you're going to have to trust me to do it one day at a time, this day. You know who is deeply influenced by this teaching? Give us this day. What type of bread? Jesus talking about manna. Give us this day our daily bread. He's talking about the manna principle. The manna rule. This manna, God meets the needs that I have today. I'm not going to ask for guarantees about tomorrow. I don't ask for answers to questions that I'm not being asked yet. And I don't ask for the ability to cross a bridge that I haven't even come upon yet. God, I'm going to trust you for this day, my daily bread today. And when I wake up tomorrow morning, like manna, here's what I know. Your mercies will be new tomorrow as well. If I wake up. God, I'm going to make my life an adventure and trusting you one day at a time, just today. You know how humbling that thought is? This has really been a humbling thing for me to think about, this principle, because I do what the Israelites do. I worry and I grumble. I do. And here's what's humbling about that is that usually when I do that, it's not about some selfless community component. Usually when I worry and I grumble, you know who it's about? It's about my agenda. It's usually about what I want, expectations I have. It's usually not about some selfless community issue. I have some unmet expectation that I have for somebody else. But the problem is, usually they don't know I have that expectation, but I'm angry at them for it. A lot of times that's called marriage. Other times I worry about how some project of mine is going to turn out. Or I wonder what people are going to think about me. I wonder what my future is going to be like. Usually it's because I'm carrying around a burden that is just this stupid burden anyway in my life that really doesn't amount to much. But man, I've made it a big deal in my life. And the problem is, guys, I can just get preoccupied with me. And you know what? I bet I'm not the only one in this room, huh? Guys, you're going to be tempted, especially when you go home at the end of this week, to worry. You're going to worry about your future. You're going to worry about your money. You're going to worry about your body. You're going to worry about your marriage. You're going to worry about your kids. You're going to worry about your job. You're going to worry about a tough meeting that's coming up. You're going to worry about something you think you just have to have, and you're going to get all anxious about it. And instead, when those moments come up, with any of those thoughts and feelings come up, I just want you to turn to God and say, God, just give me manna for today. Just this day. Give me enough of your wisdom today. Give me enough of your patience today. Give me enough of your courage to face what I have to do today. Give me enough love to handle this day. And as best as I can, God, I'll trust that when I wake up in the morning, You're going to be the first face I see in the morning because you are Emmanuel. You're the covenant-keeping God who keeps his promises, who gives me his presence, who gives me his power, who gives me his provision. You are Emmanuel. So I'm not going to try to collect from you more than I need. I'm just going to learn to trust you for this day, and I'm going to fully live. I'm going to fully inhabit today. And I'm not living out there anymore. I'm going to be in your presence this day. Guys, do you understand to what extent the joy and fullness that God offers in his kingdom when we live like that? Learning to live by this one simple principle, the principle of manna, one day at a time. We can live in the confidence with God, in a covenant with God, in amazing ways if we're just able to learn this one principle. And it's going to take a while to learn because worry has a hold on a lot of us. But the secret is every time that worry pops in, claim the manna principle. I have a friend who is very influential in this process with me, and he says, you know what I do? I've got it in my mirror in my bathroom. I wake up in the morning and I see manna. And then I get in my car and I got a post-it note on my dashboard that says manna. And then I get into my cubicle in my office and on my computer screen, I have a post-it note. And you know what it says, Dan? Manna. I am continually reminded that this is the God who provides for me one day at a time, my daily bread. That's what God's trying to teach his children in the wilderness, but they're slow learners. Let's move forward to Exodus 17. The people are thirsty again. Again, you just go... I get frustrated with them. I go, where's your faith? And then I have to look in the mirror, and that takes care of that. Why can't you just be willing to wait on God? Can't you just pray to him? Exodus 17:3, the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, why'd you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst? And then the key phrase, their key complaint is found in verse 7. Is the Lord among us or not? What's the foundation of the covenant? I'm with you. And these people have now gotten to a point and they say, is he with us or not? It's unbelievable. The 10 plagues, the deliverance from Pharaoh, the parting of the sea, the destruction of the Egyptian army, the giving of manna, the giving them of the water, and their question is he with us or isn't he? They're such slaves to their desire for the moment, for instant gratification. And once more, God is patient. And once more, he provides and he leads them to the Mount Sinai. And a number of chapters in Exodus, as you know, are spent on Mount Sinai. Turn over to Exodus 32. We're told in Exodus 24, that Moses is up on the mountain for over 40 days and 40 nights. They're given one instruction. You know what it is, the people? Wait. Not a lot of hoops to jump through. Here's what I want you to do. I'm going up to this mountain to meet with God, and here's what I want you to do. Wait. Be patient. All they've got to do is wait. Find enough faith to just wait on God. Exodus 32:1, when the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, come make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses, anybody notice the language there? For old what's his name? Oh yeah, the guy who brought us out of slavery. Amazing, I forgot his name now. As for that fella, help me out. What's it start with? M? Okay, Moses, that's it. As for Moses, who brought us out of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him. And the key word is go. Make us gods who will go before us. They don't want to wait. They're not interested in God's timing. They don't understand that he's got great reasons for wanting them to be rooted right where they are for a while, that he's preparing them during this journey time. He's character forming them. They just want to get out of this desert. They want to get to the milk and honey place. Are we there yet? Immediate gratification. They wanted it so badly, they would prefer to have a golden calf they could manipulate than a living God that they would obey. And honestly, guys, a lot of us are like that, because with the golden calf, you get your way. I get to play God in my life. I get to control my destiny. And amazingly enough, Aaron gives in. He knew better, but he would not stand up to them, so he fashions a golden calf. And there's this tremendous irony. Moses is out on the mountaintop. He's receiving the Ten Commandments from God. He's making a covenant with God. By the way, remember when he came down with the stone tablets? You know what that was, what he was doing up there. He was negotiating the terms, or he wasn't negotiating. He was receiving the terms of the covenant. Unilateral, God is giving him the terms. Now, when we come down, and we remember Charlton Heston coming down, there was five over here, and there was five over here. There's the Ten Commandments, right? When you make a contract today, who gets a copy? Everybody gets a copy. Here's your copy. Here's my copy. When Moses comes down, he's got his copy for the people. And whose other copy does he have? He's got God's copy. Anybody remember what went into the Ark of the Tabernacle? Now, why would he have God's copy? Where's God? God is with them. Do you understand the importance of him having both copies? When he came down, he had their copy of the contract, and he had God's copy, because God was with them. That is so cool. But while this is happening, at the same time, the people of the covenant are down below worshiping an idol. They're engaging in all kinds of sexually repulsive practices that were part of the worst kind of pagan fertility cults that God was trying to rid the human race of. And Moses comes down the mountain, and he is ticked. And we see here another key lesson Israel needed to learn in the wilderness, and it's about taking responsibility for your actions. You know, that's always a struggle, isn't it? Do you remember when God came up to Adam? What did he say to him? Adam, where are you? And we look at that and we go, again, guys, let's just peel back the onion a little bit. This is omniscient, all-knowing God. When he says to Adam, Adam, where are you? He's not going, that stinker is the best hide-and-seek player I've ever seen in my life. It's not like he doesn't know. What he's saying is, Adam, where are you in relationship to me? What have you done? Where are we? And now we come back, and here's another opportunity for responsibility. Where are you? Moses confronts Aaron. Look at Exodus 32:21. And Moses says to Aaron, Aaron, what did these people do to you that you led them into such great sin? In other words, Aaron, my brother, what pressure did these people put you under? How did they coerce you into doing such an evil thing? Because I can't see any other way you would have done this. This had to be pressure, and you cracked. And Aaron's response is, don't be angry. Now notice this next phrase, my Lord, Aaron answered. Again, who's Aaron to Moses? Any of you guys ever call your siblings my Lord? This guy knows he's in hot water. Moses, my Lord. He's laying it on thick because he's trying to appease Moses. Don't be angry, my Lord. Aaron answered, you know how prone these people are to evil. deflection. Let me blame them. It's not on me. Then I love this excuse that Aaron tries to get away with. They said to me, make us gods who will go before us, and for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him. So I told them, whoever has any gold jewelry, take it off. Then they gave me the gold. I threw it in the fire, and out came this calf. Abracadabra. Weirdest thing I've ever seen in my life. Freaky. We throw in the gold. Purifies, fire goes out. I got a gold calf standing there. Never seen anything like it in my life, Moses. Unbelievable. But it's just the same old tendency, the ability or the refusal to say, this is what I did. Here's my part. I take responsibility. And the judgment of God is poured out on this idolatry and immorality, and it's severe. The people who reject and defy him are killed rather than be allowed to infect and destroy the whole community, which they would have done. And God in Exodus 33, in a sense, says to Moses, I can't take this. You go ahead to the promised land. I'm going to send an angel with you. But I am not going to go with you. This kind of rebellion and sin will end in the destruction of the whole community. I don't want that. And then the prayer of one man pleading for God to be in their presence. Look at Exodus 33:15. This is a wonderful request. Then Moses said to him, if your presence doesn't go with us, don't send us up from here. Moses is saying, you know, God, even though you're offering to send us to the promised land, to this place flowing with milk and honey, and give us security and give us peace and give us affluence, you've given us the Ten Commandments, you've given us moral guidance along the way, I'd rather live here in the desert with you than a life of abundance away from you. I'd rather live in a desert with you, God, and I'd rather stay right here at the foot of this deserted mountain than to live in affluence without you. Your presence is invaluable to me. There's nothing that measures to that. Do you ever say that? Whatever it means, God, I just want to be with you. If there's things you're asking me to sacrifice in my life, I will give them up. The land of milk and honey, all your provision, I just need you and want to be with you. And God says, I am going to go with you, Moses, and I'll go with my people. But they're slow learners. We're going to jump over to Numbers 11 now. Israelites have left Mount Sinai. We're told in Numbers 10 that they leave on the 20th day of the second month of the second year. In other words, it's been over a year since they left. They've camped out at Mount Sinai for most of that time. And now it finally looks like the last leg of the journey. They're on the Mount Seir Road headed north. It's about a two-week trip. Numbers chapter 11, verse 4. The rabble with them began to crave other food, and again the Israelites started wailing. These guys are masters of this, aren't they? If only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. Also the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. Oy! But now we have no more appetite. You've killed our taste buds. All we ever see is manna. Thanks so much. They're back on this food kick again. Complaining about the menu. And it's starting to get to Moses. Look at verse 10. Moses heard the people of every family wailing, each at the entrance of their tents. I mean, it's kind of comical, isn't it? Kind of walking through the through the neighborhood. You think you got it bad. They're wailing. Oh, my goodness. Then the Lord became exceedingly angry, and Moses was troubled. And Moses gets to the point where it's the last straw. And he says, he asked the Lord, why did you do this to me? What have I done to displease you that you put these people around me? Did I conceive these people? Did I give these people birth? Why do you tell me to carry them in my arms as a nurse carries an infant to the land you promise and as an oath to their ancestors? What's he saying to him? They're your kids, not mine. Take back your kids. We've had them in our house long enough. Where can I get meat for all these people? They keep wailing to me, give me meat, give me meat. I can't carry all these people by myself. The burden's too heavy. This is how you're going to treat me? I just have one request. Kill me! If you want me to keep caring for these people, here's what I want you to do right now. Kill me! I can't do it anymore. Put me to death right now. It's kind of a dangerous prayer to send up. But God is still merciful with his little whiners. But this time there's a little judgment mixed in with the mercy. This shows God's sense of humor. Numbers 11, 18, this is God speaking. Tell the people, consecrate yourselves in preparation for tomorrow when you will eat meat. The Lord heard you when you wailed. So did everybody else. If we only had meat to eat, we were better off in Egypt. Now the Lord will give you meat, and you're going to eat it. And you're not going to eat it for just one day or 2 days or 5 or 10 or 20 days, but you're going to eat it for a whole month until it comes out of your nose. And you loathe it because you have rejected the Lord who is among you, and you have wailed before him saying, why did we ever leave Egypt? So God says, okay, I'll give you what you asked for. I'm going to give you exactly what you asked for. But you're going to learn a real spiritual lesson. Sometimes what you ask for is not what you need. And they'd have their opportunity to learn what their real problem was, which was diagnosed in verse 20. You have rejected the Lord who is among you. Here's God right here today, but all you can think about is what you don't have in your life, instead of embracing what he has provided today. All right, the journey continues. Have you noticed how when people are together for a long time in close quarters, things can get a little ugly? Can you imagine going 40 years with your in-laws? Eee. That's what my wife says. I'm not saying that. Quick recovery. But here's, things are getting tense. And all of a sudden in Numbers 11, 26, these two guys in the camp begin to prophesy. Nobody prophesies except Moses. And God has some of the elders prophesy every once in a while, but all of a sudden, these two dudes just pop up and start prophesying. Their names are Eldad and Medad. Now, you have to imagine this. All of a sudden, the Spirit just descends on them out of the blue, and people see this. Joshua, who is Moses' protege, tells Moses to stop them because Moses is supposed to be the one who prophesies. And that's what makes Moses special. And if Moses is special and Joshua is his protege, what does that make Joshua? He's special, too. If I'm the wingman for Moses, that makes me a pretty special guy. But if everybody's going to start prophesying, that kind of knocks me down the ladder. Now look at what Moses says in verse 29. Joshua says, Moses, my Lord, stop them. Don't you ever think when Moses starts hearing this my Lord stuff, he gets a little shaky? People who usually call him that usually have a slap around the back coming at him, you know? Moses replied, are you jealous for my sake? Let me tell you something, Joshua. I wish that all the Lord's people were prophets and that the Lord would put his spirit on all of them. Guess what, Joshua? I really don't want to be special anymore. I don't want to be more unique. I don't want to be more spiritual than anybody. I wish that God would do this for all of his people, which he has done now, hasn't he? Through the Holy Spirit. Look at Numbers 12, 1 and 2. Because not everybody in Israel had that same attitude. Miriam and Aaron began to talk against Moses because of his Cushite wife, for he had married a Cushite. Has the Lord spoken only through Moses, they asked? Hasn't he also spoken through us? And the Lord heard this. Now, Cush in the Bible usually refers to Ethiopia. Almost always when you see the word Cush, it refers to the country that we call Ethiopia. And some people think, well, maybe they're talking about Zipporah. No, where was Zipporah from? Do you remember? Midian. She's on the other side of the Sinai Peninsula. This is Cush, which is in North Africa. And so it probably means that Moses took a second wife, but Moses married a woman from Africa. He married a black woman. This is a racially mixed marriage. And Miriam and Aaron don't like it. And actually what's happening here is they are appealing to the people's racist attitudes. Can you believe this? Moses has married a black woman, a Cushite. Now think what this would have done to Moses. This is his wife, and here are his own brother and his sister assaulting and slandering her and him. And underneath their words is jealousy and rebellion to his authority because God has used Moses so strongly. And basically they're saying, aren't we special too? And God has to act, so he visits them in a cloud of glory. He reaffirms Moses' leadership, and then look at verse 10. When the cloud lifted from above the tent, there stood Miriam, leprous, white as snow. That's a judgment upon her. She's leprous like snow, and a number of Old Testament scholars note the irony of this judgment. It's as if God is saying to Miriam, is Moses' wife not white enough for you? You think white is a really great thing? Well, let's just go all the way then. And Aaron pleads with Moses to intercede for them. He calls Moses, my Lord, once again. Moses says the shortest prayer in the Old Testament in verse 13, oh God, please heal her, and God does. But it takes 7 days. And I can almost hear Moses praying this. Oh God, please heal her. And then under his breath, but don't be so quick about it. I mean, where does jealousy and envy come from? And I think where it comes from is Miriam and Aaron can't trust God's love, God's care, God's reward and blessing on their lives enough. They can't trust that God's going to take care of them enough. And all this stuff just bubbles up inside them like it does you and me. Make me special. Help me be recognized. All this comparison stuff, all this competitive stuff, all this envy stuff that we deal with in this fallen world. But underneath all that is really just the inability to say, all right, God, I trust you and I'm going to take your manna for today. I don't have to be like this. I don't have to go there. You are with me in your presence, in your power, in your provision for today, and I can rest in that. It's enough. And this brings us to the great crossroads of this wilderness experience, Numbers 13:1. The Lord said to Moses, send some men to explore the land of Canaan, which I'm going to give to the Israelites. From each ancestral tribe, send one of its leaders. So at the Lord's command, Moses sent them out from the desert of Paran, all the leaders of Israel. He sends out 12 spies. They're heading for Canaan, so they get real close. They're ready to go over now. They're gone 40 days. They come back, and they file their report. Verse 27. They gave Moses this account. We went into the land for which you sent us, and man, does it ever flow with milk and honey. Here's some of the fruit that we found. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified, and they're very large. We saw the descendants of Anak there. This is a real dangerous place, strong opposition. They're going to kick our butts. And as you can imagine, when the people heard this, they became very discouraged. Except for two spies, Joshua and Caleb gave a dissenting report. Verse 30, then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, let's do it. This is our land, and I know we can do it. But the people don't believe it. They don't believe that God's protection is enough for them one day at a time in this new land. Verse 33, it's a poignant image here. The people said, the land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. The descendants of Anak came from Nephilim. And here's the sentence. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, as we looked the same to them. When we look in a mirror, we look like insects. We look like grasshoppers. We're just grasshoppers. No strength. We could never do this. We're not able. You see, they've never really recovered what from this slave mentality. They have this victim mentality, and they can't get beyond it. They've got no dreams. They got no power. And the tragedy is this generation would never see themselves as anything but grasshoppers. They never would. That's all they ever saw in a mirror. They were never really willing to trust God on this great adventure one day at a time. And so God says, okay, you don't have to go. You get your wish. You can stay here in the desert. You don't have to go back to Egypt and be slaves. I'm also not going to make you go to the promised land. Because it's obvious if they did, it would be a disaster. So God says, don't go. Next generation will be able to see themselves as something more than just grasshoppers. And I'm going to send them, but you're going to stay here. So God has given them their wish, and he made it a commandment. And now they have to stay. Turn over to Numbers 14:39. Again, these people are getting what they asked for. They don't want to go. God says, okay, you can't go. You must stay here. Verse 39, when Moses reported this to all the Israelites, they mourned bitterly. This is what they asked for, and now they're mourning bitterly that God gave them what they asked for. Early the next morning, they went up toward the hill of the high country. We have sinned, they said. We're going to go up to the place the Lord promised. But Moses said, why are you disobeying the Lord's command? This is not going to work. Don't go up because the Lord is not with you. You will be defeated by your enemies, for the Amalekites and the Canaanites will face you there. And because you've turned away from the Lord, he will not be with you, and you are going to fall by the sword. Nevertheless, in their presumption, they went up towards the high hill country, though neither Moses nor the Ark of the Lord's covenant moved from the camp. Then the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in that hill country came down, attacked them, and beat them all the way down to Hormah. They're just like little kids. When God says go, they say, we don't want to go. You can't make us go. God says, fine, don't go. Well, we want to go. You can't tell us we can't go. It's like a 2-year-old, isn't it? It's like an 11-year-old. Gary Smalley once said, you know, when you strip away all of our life experience and the sanctification that happens in our lives, we're all 2-year-olds. Because we have two favorite words, no and mine. And when you strip away all the things we've learned about how the living community and the sanctification process, if we're left to ourselves and the depravity of ourselves, our two favorite words are, no. Why? Because it's mine. It's about me. You want to share? Nope. Okay, don't go. No, we want to go. So they disobey God and they get whacked. But God does not desert his people because he's a covenant-keeping God. He says in 14:20 that he forgives them. And he stays with them and he keeps watch over them and he keeps the manna supply going. But the reality is they will never know what might have been. They never know the adventure of what it would have been like to enter the promised land of God. They would never know that. And I point this out because there will be some of you in this room today that I know God is calling you on an adventure. God's asking you to do something, to step up. Maybe it's an involvement in a ministry. Maybe it's something with your family. Maybe it's a financial thing that you've been given in financial and we saw opportunities to invest it into people, into God's causes. Maybe it's reconciling a relationship that's been broken for so, so long that just weighs so heavily on you. I don't know, but you do know what it is. And you're this close. But there's something inside of you saying, just look in the mirror, because all you are is a grasshopper. You're not adequate, you're not competent, you're not strong enough, and you know what? You're not. And neither am I. But with God's help, we can do anything. The question is, are we willing to trust God one day at a time? You see, I think it's such a sad thing that there was this whole generation who would never go on this adventure, this journey with God. Because when they looked in the mirror, all they ever saw was that I'm a grasshopper in my own eyes. One more episode in the wilderness. Numbers 20, verse 2. Now there was no water for the community, and the people gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron. They quarreled with Moses and said, "If only we had died when our brothers fell dead before the Lord. Why did you bring the Lord's community into the desert that we and our livestock should die here? Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to this terrible place? It has no grain or figs, grapevines or pomegranates, and there's no water to drink." It's getting a little repetitive again. Moses and Aaron went from the assembly to the entrance of the tent of the meeting, fell face down, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. The Lord said to Moses, "Take the staff, you and your brother Aaron, gather the assembly together, speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. You will bring water out of the rock for the community so that they and their livestock can drink." So Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence, just as he had commanded him. He and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock, and Moses said to them, "Listen, you rebels, must we bring water out of this rock?" Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock twice with his staff. Water gushed out, and the community and their livestock drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land that I give them." Seems a little severe, doesn't it? And we wonder, why does God treat Moses this way? And I'll tell you what I think. And this is not original with me, but this is what I think is going on. The key is in verse 10 when Moses turns to the people and he says, "Listen, you rebels, must we?" Not God. Must we bring water out of this rock? And then he dramatically strikes the rock instead of speaking to it as God asked him to do. And the implication is this: Moses and his brother Aaron are the miracle workers. They're the ones who are doing the power here. Now, I want you to think about this. His whole life task has been to take people who were used to thinking that their leader was a god. That's what Pharaoh was, right? And teaching them that there's only one sovereign God. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." And now you have to imagine by now that Moses must have almost seemed divine-like to these people, right? Everything he's done, I mean, this guy is the greatest. He is up on Mount Sinai with God. He's the one who talked to God, and when he came down, his face was radiant. And there is, I think, a real danger that he would attain a kind of godlike status among them, and that they would become so dependent upon Moses that it would hinder and it would destroy the next generation. So God says, when the time comes to go in, and it's not here, but when it comes, you're not going in. Because developmentally, it would not be good. And I also want to point out one other thing, and then I'm going to close here. God cuts Moses' life short, as he does with a number of people in the Old Testament. And I think there's some misinterpretation with this. It doesn't mean that Moses was under judgment, eternal judgment. Actually, he's going to be in the presence of the Lord. Seems like a pretty good reward to me. So in a sense, it's not as much punishment because he gets his reward. So it's important to keep in mind that death from our perspective is different from death from God's perspective. He's cutting Moses' life shorter, but it doesn't mean that he's under his judgment or he's under his punishment. When they go in the promised land, this next generation, they'll learn what it means to trust God alone. So we're going to leave them in the wilderness right now. We're going to pick it up again tomorrow. But I just want to close by asking you this. How's your journey going? How's your time in the wilderness? Maybe you're in the wilderness right now. God has things that he can teach you while you're here. And I just want to tell you, remember the manna. Remember the manna. Today when you go back to your rooms, tomorrow morning when you wake up, God is here. God will provide today. You know, it's like being a food server in Israel would have been the easiest job around, wouldn't it have? You know what's for breakfast tomorrow? Manna. Manna, 365 days a year. I can tell you what the menu is going to be for you guys tomorrow. When you wake up, God will be with you. God is going to watch you. And God is going to know everything that is going on in your life, and he's going to know you to the deepest core. And he's going to care for you. And he's going to love you. And he's going to deliver you. And he's going to provide for you. God will give you what you need, and you'll have a chance to go to the wilderness with him tomorrow, but just if you do, remember the manna. Just do life with God one day at a time. Father, we thank you for this message today. We live in such a rushed world, and we're constantly thinking of what's next, and we miss you here today. We thank you that you provide for us every day. Pray that our eyes would be focused on you, focused on our daily bread, and not get caught into the competition and the envy and the what ifs, but to enjoy your presence here today and your provision here today and your deliverance here today. Give us our daily bread in Jesus' name. Amen.